You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. Coming up in the next hour, French President François Hollande looks set to emerge with a majority in Parliament after his Socialist Party fared well in yesterday's legislative elections. We'll get the latest with Monocle contributor Christine Ocran. The President of the Philippines met with Barack Obama at the White House on Friday, but what was top of his agenda? Will shed light on the strategic relationship between the American superpower and its former colony in Southeast Asia. We'll also discuss China's ambitious space exploration program, we'll review the winners and losers from last night's Tony Awards on Broadway, and we'll have a global affairs chat with Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. One minute past six here in London. Time for the news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The international mediator Kofi Annan has voiced concern today over the shelling of the Syrian opposition stronghold of Homs and reports of the use of mortar bombs, helicopters and tanks in Haffa. In Geneva, his spokesman Awad Fawazi said Annan was particularly worried about civilians still trapped.
Mr. Annan is particularly worried about the recent shelling in Homs, as well as reports of the use of mortar, helicopters and tanks in the town of Al-Haffa in Latakia. There are indications that a large number of civilians are trapped in these towns. Mr. Annan demands that parties take all steps to ensure that civilians are not harmed.
Polish authorities have appealed for calm today ahead of a planned march by some 5,000 Russian fans from the centre of Warsaw to the National Stadium, where Russia will play their Euro 2012 Group A match against Poland. The two neighbours have always had complicated relations, strained by historical animosity and the Soviet domination after World War II, and also a plane crash that killed Poland's president along with 95 others in Russia 2 years ago at first brought the two nations together, only to push them apart due to disputes over who was responsible and the progress of the investigation. The former British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has given evidence to the Levinson inquiry into media standards. He insists he and his wife, Sarah, never gave permission to the Sun newspaper to print details about his young son, Fraser's cystic fibrosis in 2006. He also accused media tycoon, Rupert Murdoch, of misleading the government-sponsored inquiry into press ethics with incorrect testimony, alleging Brown had threatened war against Murdoch's company.
This is the conversation that Mr. Murdoch says happened between him and me, that where I threatened him and where I'm alleged to have acted in an unbalanced way. This conversation never took place. I'm shocked and surprised that it should be suggested, even when there's no evidence of such a conversation, that it should have happened. But there was no such conversation.
Staying here, and the current British Prime Minister, David Cameron, accidentally left his daughter behind in a country pub after a Sunday lunch with friends, following a mix-up over which car she was meant to be going home in, his Downing Street office has said today. He was swiftly reunited with 8-year-old Nancy. Well, Kate O'Donovan from the organisation Mum's Net said most people were actually sympathetic to the British Prime Minister.
Well, lots of people have been talking about it on Mum's Net today, and there's actually quite a lot of sympathy for him. Parents are busy people, often sleep deprived. Particularly when your children outnumber the number of parents that are out and about, it can happen to the best of us. So I think there is some sympathy out there for Cameron today.
Peru's President Ollanta Humala has defended a controversial Xstrata mine project. While at a conference in Switzerland today, Humala's government has come down hard on protesters in the Peruvian mountain town of Espina, where people say Xstrata's Tintaya copper mine causes pollution. Late last month, police arrested the mayor of Espina after violent clashes between authorities and angry demonstrators. And finally, in the concrete jungle of Tokyo, some 600 retirees have gathered to fight for supremacy with blow darts. The ancient Borneo rainforest tradition of blow darting is picking up new fans thousands of miles away in Japan, where it is a rapidly growing sport among, would you believe it, the nation's elderly. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Incredulity in your voice there, Jonathan. Would you believe it? It's 5 minutes past six here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. As a Monocle 24.
Welcome to Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
London, Bursa, Monocle 24.
London, στο Καζίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
London, as a Monocle 24.
London, Bursa, Monocle 24.
London, ist sinun Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que você está ouvindo é Monocle 24.
Isso é Monocle 24.
Você escuta Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, Hagat, ja.
Now, after a strong first-round showing in the vote for the National Assembly yesterday, President François Hollande of France will be hoping to maintain the newfound unity in the Socialist Party and secure a majority in the final round of legislative elections next week. To give us an update and discuss the implications of yesterday's result, Monocle's regular French election contributor Christine Ocrant is on the line now. Welcome, Christine. Thanks for joining us.
OK.
Give us the context here. What's actually at stake in these elections?
Well, what is at stake is, in fact, the margin of maneuver which the new president and his government will be able to act with for the coming 2 years. And it's particularly important regarding Europe and the Eurozone. The fact that yesterday the extreme left with Mélenchon, who had made a very strong showing at the first round of the presidential election. Well, he got beaten up and his troops will hardly have any seats in parliament, which means that there will be no harrowing, if you will, on the extreme left, at least within parliament. It may be later in the streets, you know, in the fall when there will probably be social unrest, but within parliament that is being contained. Now, what is interesting is, of course, the extreme right, because Marine Le Pen has indeed managed quite well yesterday, but we have a complicated system, you know, so much more complicated than the British one. You have to take into account the very high level of people who just didn't go and bother to vote because they're just tired of voting. You know,
that was a record low. Is that right? Turnout was around 57%.
That's right. And that makes the job more difficult for the extreme right to gain seats in parliament, because our rule goes that in order to have a seat, you have to justify 12.5% of people who are actually enlisted, and not only people who go and vote. So the extreme right has almost 14%. And what is interesting is that when you look at the figures, as I'm doing right now, the socialists have won about 34.4, and the conservatives 34.1. Now, it's comfortable for Hollande and his government because the socialists can easily make deals with the other smaller leftist parties.
Which, for example, the Greens. Exactly.
Whereas it's very complicated, or very dicey, shall we say, for the conservatives to make any open deal with the extreme right.
Yeah.
And so it will really be a sort of case by case. But to make it simple for a non-French audience, or believe me, even for a French audience, let's say that Hollande has passed a comfortable majority. It hasn't showed, you know, an extraordinary enthusiasm for his program, but it hasn't either been the sort of typical balancing act which the French at times like to play with.
Now, if the Socialists win an absolute majority, it will be the first time in modern history that the party's had control of both houses of the French Parliament, the Assembly and the Senate. It's clearly looking good for François Hollande, but is success a certainty, do you think?
It's not a certainty that he gains the absolute majority. He may be close to it. In any case, he'll have a comfortable majority. And he's sufficiently astute a politician to understand that, paradoxically, it may be better for him not to have an absolute majority, because, as you say very rightly, if he appears to be in control of all the institutions of the Republique, then it will be a very, very sort of, you know, heavy rock to move. If he has a very large majority and not an absolute one, it's almost better, in my view.
He will, as we briefly mentioned, be looking to form an alliance with the Greens, because they are also pro-Europe. If in the end he needs the support of far-left parties that are more anti-European, how will that complicate his efforts to work with Germany to strengthen the euro and promote growth, do you think?
Well, frankly, at this stage, the extreme left, which includes the former Communist Party, will not have that many seats. And so their voice will not be heard all that much. So that's, it's not so much of a complication for the government. The Greens are people who are very difficult to tame, as you know, and although they're already in the government, Cécile Duflot, their leader, is Minister of Housing, and she's already demonstrated her ability not to be very sort of to play with the team, but they're inside, and they too, because of the high level of abstention, will not get that many seats either. So what really is interesting to watch for next Sunday, it's a few key French political personalities, starting with Ségolène Royal, the former candidate five years ago, the former companion of the current president. And she is...
As you say, things are much more complicated in French politics than they are in British politics.
Well, yeah, sometimes more fun, but not always.
You mentioned that very high abstention rate. It's much higher than in May's presidential election. What do you think we can deduce from that? I mean, you talked about sort of malaise and people being bored of elections.
Yes, and it's also, there's a very amusing cartoon by Plantu, who is the famous cartoonist who works for Le Monde. And I'm looking at it right now, and it's about the abstention. And you have a guy who's obviously gone fishing, and he says, "Pooh, Sarko is not around anymore, so it's not fun." And seriously, I think the anti-Sarkozy mood was so strong for the presidential campaign that it motivated people one way or another. Now, for parliamentary elections, given the level of distrust which exists in France, as in other democracies, vis-à-vis our political elites, people say, okay, if it's this guy who's elected or that guy, it won't make much of a difference. And I think that's basically the reason why so many people didn't just go and put a ballot in the box.
Sarkozy, though, is still around. His party, the Union for a Popular Movement. I mean, these elections are still critical for the Conservative Party's fighting to define that opposition space in a way. His party have said that they will not in any way go into allegiances with the National Front. Can you shed a bit more light on what's going on between those two factions?
Yes, it is the traditional attitude of the Conservatives vis-à-vis the Front National. That's what they say at the national level. Mm. But when you have one man or woman who desperately wants to get his or her seat back in various places, that person may well not listen to the national leaders and make local deals. And it's already the case in the south of France. There's one UMP MP who has said, I don't want the socialist guy to win just because there's a sort of triangle that would favor him. And so I will bring my votes to the extreme right. So you will have a few spots like that, individual cases, where people will make that move one way or another. There's another place, it's interesting because it weakens the former spokeswoman for Sarkozy, a young and very bright woman called Nathalie Kosciusko-Morizet, who used to be an MP near Paris, and she has been very adamant against Marine Le Pen and the extreme right. And as a revenge, Le Pen has said, okay, as she has been, you know, so tough and rough on us, I ask my people to vote for the socialist who is running against the that former conservative minister. So you will have a few cases like that. But overall, there has never been, and there is not going to be, a sort of national alliance from the top down between traditional conservatives and the extreme right.
Christine Ocron, keeping a close eye on the fascinating political situation in France as it develops for us. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House, where we're about to enjoy some music, so do stay with us.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition, complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
six o'clock in the evening here in Studio One in London. This is Midori House with me, Clemency Burton Hill. Time now for a song. This is Nasta Dag by Lisa Ekdahl. Nasta Dag by Lisa Ekdahl here on Midori House. Well, last Friday saw the first Oval Office meeting between President Obama and President Aquino of the Philippines. The talks were expected to cover security alliances and the question of US troop numbers in its former colony. But they took place amid rising tensions between the Philippines and China, an issue that was presumably high on President Aquino's agenda. Well, to discuss the state of US-Philippines relations, we're joined now by Dr. Alessio Patilano, Asian defence expert and lecturer in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Welcome, Alessio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening.
So, we know what should have been on the agenda. Do you know what they actually talked about on Friday?
Well, I wasn't there, so I don't know firsthand. But reports were quite clear about a number of important points. Now, obviously, security and military matters, military affairs were priority items in the agenda. And of course, this meant two different types of discussions. One about the state of bilateral relations between the Philippines and the United States. The other, you know, regional issues. As part of the wider repositioning of the United States in the Pacific.
And what's the context? I mean, talk to us about what's really going on between the Philippines and China. There's that disputed area of the South China Sea.
Absolutely. No, I suppose that is a very important point to make. I mean, all of these discussions, and in particular, I suppose that, you know, a few months back, it would have drawn a lot less attention, this type of meeting. But, of course, in light especially of the standoff, Scarborough Shoal, of which we talked about in the past, of course, it took a little bit of a spotlight, this particular meeting. Now, the important thing to say is that I thought that the meeting was reassuring, but at the same time, there was a sense that neither side really wanted to see this meeting as a statement of, by the way, we're going to remilitarize the Philippines in order to contain China. I think both sides, both President Obama, President Aquino, were quite sort of like clear about the fact that they didn't want to send out that message. They wanted to reassure the Philippines wanted to be reassured about the situation, but of course they didn't want to go sort of a bridge too far about this.
But how frustrating is it for the Philippines that the US so far have taken no position on those South China Sea rivalries?
Well, I suppose that, you know, it isn't, in the sense that this is pretty much this is a national issue, in the sense that there is a defense agreement, a bilateral agreement between the United States and the Philippines, but at the same time, the question of how a boundary, how a territorial ownership is established is something that really pertains to question of, you know, state functions. So it's something that obviously the United States don't want to be involved into directly. Indirectly, of course, by restating their support to the Philippines. And in fact, I think a very important point, of which I don't know if it was confirmed, but, you know, in April, the Obama administration pledged to increase its foreign military sales to the Philippines up to $30 million, which would be like three times more than 2011. So we're talking about, and one thing that was confirmed was the sale of another Coscat cutter to the Filipino Navy.
Activists did stage a protest outside the US Embassy in Manila on Friday. What were they protesting about?
I think they were absolutely touching upon what we were just mentioning. Mm. You know, their protests centered around the fact that there is a sense of, yes, in the Philippines we have a problem in terms of parts of our territory that are under dispute, and of course we are all worried about our next door neighbor, China, for it. Sort of like a clear and equal distribution of sheer power between two countries. That said, they don't want to see the Philippines becoming a forefront, sort of a front line of a potential containment strategy. And this is a very important point. I think that if we look at what in the statement was made clear at the end of the visit, this 3 days visit, again, the United States, from the United States, we do not hear anything about access, you know, leasing permanent bases or the opening of new bases in the Philippines. Rather, the sort of discussion about American military presence in the Philippines is based more about the standard rotation of forces as part of the wider realignment that would include the particular, in particular, the presence of more troops in Australia. So as part of that rotation, of course, the United States will get access to Filipino bases, including, well, and of course there was nothing really specific written in stone, but one would suspect that reference to maritime and air bases would probably refer to Subic Bay and Clark Airfield.
Now, I believe that it has been mooted that the US might return three church bells that were seized as spoils of war from the Philippines more than a century ago. People are saying that that gesture would go a long way towards demonstrating real goodwill to what is basically a very old and steadfast US ally in the West Pacific, but that's not going down very well with certain US veterans, is it?
Yes, of course, but again, I mean, this is the other, if you wanted, this is the other facet of the question, isn't it? I mean, the same way we've got a certain number of sensitivities in the Philippines, then of course you've got them also in the United States. And, you know, this is not the first time the United States has another staunch ally in the region, you know, which it fought a very bloody war, you know, and that's the case of Japan. And so and for a number of years, we've seen issues and problems in terms of how history is remembered, how history is portrayed, and all the scars that are still bleeding from time to time. This is part of a very long-standing process.
Dr. Alessio Patilano from King's College London, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House, where it's 29 minutes past six here in London.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyos. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντος τεκασίν, τέμα ον Μόνακο 24.
Λόντον μπορ, έζε Μόνακο χωσανή.
Λόντζαντα, μπορέσε Μόνακο γερμιδάρτ.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Μόνακο 24.
Τι Λόντρις, έσαι Μόνακο 24.
Ο κυκίνινα τύρουνοα, Μόνακο 24.
Αυτό είναι το Μόνακο 24.
Vous écoutez Μόνακο 24.
Das ist Μόνακο 24.
Du listener for Μόνακο 24.
Κούντελετ Μόνακο 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talbacka.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be looking at the world of foreign affairs. We'll hear the latest on China's plan to conquer space, and we'll get an update on this year's Tony Awards. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. The international mediator Kofi Annan has voiced concern today over the shelling of the Syrian opposition stronghold of Homs and reports of the use of mortar bombs, helicopters and tanks in Hafa. He was particularly worried about civilians still trapped in those towns. Polish authorities have appealed for calm today ahead of a planned march by some 5,000 Russian fans from the centre of Warsaw to the National Stadium, where Russia will play their Euro 2012 Group A match against Poland. The two neighbours have always had complicated relations strained by historical animosity and the Soviet domination after the Second World War. The former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has given evidence to the Levinson inquiry into media standards. He insists he and his wife Sarah never gave permission to the Sun newspaper to print details about his young son Fraser's cystic fibrosis in 2006. Staying here, and the current British Prime Minister David Cameron accidentally left his daughter behind in a country pub after a Sunday lunch with friends following a mix-up over which car she was meant to be going home in. He was swiftly reunited with his 8-year-old daughter, Nancy. And Peru's President Ollanta Humala has defended a controversial ex-strata mine project while at a conference in Switzerland today. His government has come down hard on protesters in the Peruvian mountain town of Espina, where people say ex-strata's Tintaya copper mine causes pollution. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Time now to find out what stories have caught the eye of Monocle's editors this week. Today, we're joined by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to chat about the world of global affairs. Welcome, Steve.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very good indeed. Very good indeed.
Where do we start this evening?
It's going to be a bit of a round-the-world tour. We're going to start...
We like those.
Good. We're going to start in Europe with Italy. No sooner has one, debt-ravaged European country found itself a bailout, then there's another one desperately sticking its hand in the air saying we might need one too.
No surprises there, though.
Well,
it's been on the agenda for a while, has it not?
Yes, except previously when we've had previous bailouts and countries in strife, there's at least been a few weeks where we've all been able to go, good.
It's all going to be
fantastic.
Right now.
Spain sorted. And this was like, yeah, okay, great. Spain sorted. What about Italy? Now, Italy is in a very different situation to Spain. Its bond yields are ridiculously high. Their debt is high, but they've had very different reasons for that. We kind of thought that Italy, or people sort of thought that Italy was going to be all right after Mario Monti took over from Silvio Berlusconi. Obviously, lots of European leaders thought that Berlusconi was not the sort of man they wanted to lend lots and lots of money to.
Right.
Whereas Mr. Monti seemed like a thoroughly reasonable chap, a bit of a technocrat, and the sort of man who would maybe bring in some reforms, tighten belts here and there, and be the sort of person that would try and get things back on track.
But is the issue people not wanting to lend full stop because they don't have the money?
That's part of the issue, yeah. I mean, I think the underlying...
Presumably it's still better for Italy in this situation that Monti's at the helm.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. No, this is in no way a plea for the return of Silvio Berlusconi, although it was mildly amusing when he was in charge. The problem here is that the fundamental underlying crisis in Europe hasn't been dealt with. Some of the liquidity issues have been dealt with Spain's bailout, and sort of have in a piecemeal way with Greece. But the underlying issues of how you restore growth whilst also paying down debts, that still hasn't been solved. And another bailout, even if that comes, probably isn't going to solve it either.
So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, what's the best strategy now for dealing with Italy and, of course, the other European countries that might line up after Italy? As you say, no sooner one country gets a bailout than the next comes begging.
Well, indeed. I mean, the best strategy would be to do the one thing that Angela Merkel doesn't want, which is Eurobonds. And, it's a way of tying every Eurozone country together. It's a way of standing behind these countries in a way that any other central bank does, in the way that the central bank here in the UK, the Bank of England, does, in the way that the Federal Reserve does in the US, and actually guarantees the debts. Now, politically, that might be quite difficult for Angela Merkel, but increasingly it's becoming clear that the other option is that everything falls apart. And, you can say we must stick to our certain rules all you like, but there comes a time when, if the choice is sticking to the rules and making sure that, we still have an economy, then most people will think the rules are perhaps, not so important.
Do you think things could shift depending on what happens in France with the elections? If Hollande gets through, he's likely to
push
things.
I think... I think we've seen a general shift in the last two elections in Europe, with Hollande being elected, and also with the chaotic results in Greece. And we'll see again what happens at the weekend. That there is a bit of a shift, certainly amongst populations in Europe, in their attitudes towards austerity, and that is at least forcing policymakers to think about different ways through. Whether they think through it quickly enough. To be honest, everyone I speak to says, don't worry, it's going to be fine, purely because even considering what happens if things aren't fine is so monumentally awful that no one can quite bring themselves to think that we will let it fall apart. So everyone is convinced that everything's going to be all right purely because it can't possibly fall apart, because then we are all utterly screwed.
Moving on swiftly. Yeah. Where is our
let's
next
move on
stop
on
our global tour?
Let's go to Burma. So... The story in Burma for a number of years, the main story we've been focusing on, has been about democracy and lack of freedom, and about the military junta which denied Aung San Suu Kyi, who was fairly elected in 1988, not allowing her to take power, locking her up, and it's all been about the return gradually to democracy. And we've seen in recent months, with Aung San Suu Kyi's release, with her election, along with 40 or so other of her her colleagues in the opposition party, that sort of part of the story is starting to change somewhat. Less has been written about ethnic tensions within Burma, of which there have been many. I mean, it's got vast numbers of different ethnic groups. Lots of them feel that they have been not really given the freedoms that they deserve or they respect.
Can you give us a quick breakdown of how the country divides?
Oh, blimey. I'll give you a breakdown of some of them. I mean, look, the key problem...
Well, the main clashes
and tensions. The key issue at the moment has been... there's been around about, I think, 16, 17 people killed this month in violence between Buddhists and Muslims. And the main issue has been one in particular Muslim ethnic group, the Rohingya. And this is right near the border with Bangladesh. And part of the problem is that the government simply doesn't recognise the Rohingya as Burmese citizens. But we talk about quite a lot of people here. This is 800,000 people. At the moment, they're living in fairly desperate conditions that are essentially like refugee camps, but not looked after internationally. And they're considered sort of one of the largest groups of stateless people within Asia. And there's been, as I say, in recent days, there's been lots of clashes. There's a lot of tension there. It's causing enormous problems. And it's the sort of things that had sort of been ignored in the past.
Has it been widely reported this month?
It's starting to. I mean, part of the problem with all stories on Burma is that it's very hard to report on because not many people are allowed in.
Has that changed as well?
That's sort of changed recently. A lot of people are starting to get visas, but still tend to be on quite strict trips. So, I mean, it's already sort of quite difficult. And then, of course, the broader issue is that we're talking about part of the world, Southeast Asia, where a lot of news organisations are cutting back. Mm. They don't have, we've been in Bangkok recently and there's quite a few foreign journalists there, but not as many as there were 10, 15 years ago.
Same story. Isn't it?
And it's sort of Southeast Asia has kind of become a slightly neglected corner amongst Western press. I'd like to say not here at Monocle 24,
obviously,
where
we've
just appointed a very good new Bangkok correspondent, but it is one of those corners that is often neglected.
What about the Asian press and the Asian agencies? Are they in there? Are they reporting on this?
Some are, yes. But again, it depends on, which Asian country we're talking about. Yeah. If it's China, China's not really known for its stellar news coverage and perhaps wouldn't be so keen on covering ethnic tensions inside a country's own borders, not quite up their street. But certainly something to watch on over the coming weeks as that story develops.
Where are we off to next?
Okay, finally, let's go to the US. We've done an awful lot about the US elections, obviously. Big story. But one of the things that's been, that no one can really ignore is how tough the Tea Party have become in essentially creating a Republican orthodoxy and saying, if you don't sign up to all these things, whether that's on abortion, on gun control, or most importantly, on taxes and the economy, then you're not a real Republican and you can't stand. Now, Jeb Bush, who, is, as the surname suggests, is pretty much
a staunch...
As Republicans go, when your brother's been president and your dad's been president, and I think his granddad was a senator and he was the governor of Florida for two terms, he said earlier today, or in fact, it might have been just last night, that his father, George Bush, and Ronald Reagan would find themselves out of step with today's Republicans because of its strict adherence to ideology. He said his quote, a slightly meandering quote, but... He says, Ronald Reagan would have had a hard time if you define the Republican Party as having an orthodoxy that doesn't allow for disagreement. He said, back to my dad's time, Ronald Reagan's time, they got a lot of stuff done with a lot of bipartisan support that right now would be difficult to imagine happening. This is one of the most senior Republicans, as well known in the US probably as Mitt Romney, certainly on the same page, saying, look, my party's, closing down debates and not allowing any sort of disagreements, and it's doing us a lot of harm.
Wow, it's progress in a way.
It is. I mean, it's good that he's saying
that. Has he weighed in on Romney? Do we know what he thinks of Romney?
He was very careful about not coming out in support of Romney while the race was still open. I think partly because he didn't want to be, didn't get on the wrong side of whoever did become the candidate, and partly also I think because he was a little bit wary and thought, well, this guy perhaps isn't the right guy. And let's face it, if his surname wasn't Bush, he would have been running this time. Mm. And
may well still in the future. So.
Yes, I mean, I'm sure he probably will at some stage in the future. But, you know, he's a serious politician. He's, you know, far more sensible views on immigration than other senior Republicans. And he's, you know, he's almost sensible.
And wants to open up debate.
There we are.
Which is what we like here.
God, who could have
Midori
thought?
House. Steve Bloomfield, thank you so much. Here's a look at the week's stories. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, where it's 1842.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Long overshadowed by its neighbor, Seoul's creative community is flourishing as a new generation of designers are developing new projects and pieces. Monocle's Gabriel Lee traveled to South Korea to meet some of the people leading the charge.
Indeed, many in the creative community here have studied or worked abroad and now come back, melding their experience in the world with a Korean aesthetic and creating something new and appealing. This is the first generation to have done this on such a scale.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. Well, in only a matter of days, China's space agency could be celebrating a major accomplishment. The country's state media reports that three astronauts, one of them possibly a woman, will be sent into space by mid-June. In what would be the country's first manned mission to an orbiting space laboratory, the Shenzhou 9 capsule will attempt to rendezvous with Beijing's mini space station Tiangong-1. Well, with the American shuttle program permanently scuttled, the prospect for future US manned missions looking bleak, and the rise of private commercial spaceflight on the horizon, how important are programs like China's? Joining us now for an update on this is Tariq Malik, the managing editor of Space.com, which has been covering the story. Thank you for joining us, Tariq.
Well, thanks for having us. Great to be here.
So what's actually been announced? When is it likely to take place, and what will it really entail?
Well, what we learned this past weekend is that the rocket that is going to launch this new Chinese manned space mission is at the launch pad. It's assembled and put together. The spacecraft Shenzhou 9 is on top, and they're basically going through the final round of testing to make sure the rocket itself is ready to go. They said China's manned space agency that it's in the final days of testing for both the vehicle and its crew, and that they're going to launch sometime in mid-June. Now, that's either this week, possibly maybe next week as well. I think that there's usually about a week or so turnaround from the past what we've seen. This is their first manned space mission to dock at an orbiting laboratory, something that many are familiar with the International Space Station. NASA and Russia have done this in the past. But for China, it's a major first, and it's the next step for them to build their own bigger space station in orbit, which they hope to do by 2020.
And presumably they're very confident that it will take place if they, they wouldn't be making this pronouncement if it was not going to happen. Tell us more about their ambitions. You mentioned 2020. That's their major space exploration program. This Tiangong-1, I believe, is the prototype for that future space station. Is that correct?
Exactly. The Tiangong-1, which translates to Heavenly Palace, is a module. It's about the size of a bus, and it's been in orbit since last September. They launched a robotic spacecraft to it to test the docking that they're going to do with the astronauts a few months later. So they know that they can actually fly up and meet this spacecraft. And what they want to do now is show that they can send astronauts to it. The astronauts can link up with it, live on board, use its systems to perform experiments, to live in space for a week or even longer. And what that will do is show that the technology they've developed for both the the spacecraft to ferry astronauts to and from orbit, and the technology needed to actually keep them alive for extended stays in space is viable to basically scale it up into a larger space station. This is one module. It's relatively small. The astronauts can't stay there for months at a time as they do on the space station, the International Space Station. But China's plan for a big station in the 2020 timeframe is a 60-ton orbital installation. That's large enough you could see it from the ground with your naked eye.
Wow. We've been talking about China carrying out a manned space flight. There is talk there'll be a woman on board. What are the political implications of that, and do you think that's actually likely to happen?
Well, actually, what we learned today is that they are choosing one of the three crew members from China's first pool of female candidates. That was something that they had said could be a possibility. Today, we're seeing reports from state media and others that they're going to choose one of two of the Air Force pilots that have been training to be a female astronaut for China. What it does is it brings China back basically up on par with most space agencies around the world, which have a mixed crew complement, and it shows that they are actually kind of expanding their program to be a little bit more inclusive than just male fighter pilots, something that all space agencies started off with in the beginning before joining up into mixed crews.
Now, China was previously turned away from the International Space Station, which was a much bigger project run by 16 nations. Reportedly, that was after objections from the US. So what's really going on here politically between China and the US with regards to the space race?
Well, in terms of the U.S.-Chinese relations, there has been some talk about limited or partial cooperation in space between NASA and China's space program. There's been a lot of political hurdles in terms of the U.S. Stance on human rights issues in China, things that would have to be addressed to really embrace a full-fledged partnership. Does that mean that China won't be a partner in some form or fashion on unmanned or future missions? Not necessarily, but there are some things that have to be worked out to make that kind of partnership really either acceptable politically or scientifically in the United States.
Tariq Malik, the managing editor of space.com, thank you so much for joining us. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, and it's just coming up to 10 to 7 in the evening here in London.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tema on Monocle 24.
The Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, last night in New York City, British actor James Corden beat off major competition to take the Best Actor Award at the Tony Awards, New York Theatre's equivalent of an Oscar. That was for his performance in One Man, Two Governors. Other big winners on the night included the stage adaptation of the independent film Once and Cliburn Park, Bruce Norris's racial drama, which was another transfer from London's West End. Well, joining us now here in the studio for his take on this year's awards is Matt Wolfe, London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune and theatre editor at the Arts Desk. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
A pleasure.
Your thoughts on last night? Did he deserve it?
I really think James Corden deserved it. And what was great was that there tends to be the thinking the comedy doesn't win. Usually the big awards go to the serious heavy hitters. Mm. The more tragic, the more trophies. And the thing about James Corden is that, as he said in his glorious acceptance speech, the play is sort of belligerently silly and joyously so, and it was voted, the best performance by an actor over people like Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Willy Loman. So I think when his name was announced, James Corden had every right to be flabbergasted and pleased.
I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman, probably the front runner there, but also Frank Langella, James Earl Jones, John Lithgow. I mean, four incredibly heavyweight actors.
Yeah, and senior actors too. That's the other thing, is that they're all older, they have more stature, they have more weight, not necessarily literally. But the incredible thing about James Corden is that when he arrived on Broadway in April to do this play, most of the New York public didn't have a clue who he was.
Right.
And it's the kind of Cinderella story that Broadway does very well, particularly with regard to the British. It's happened before and it will happen again.
He did lose out as well in the UK. He didn't win the Olivier for it. So presumably he's feeling pretty triumphant this morning, even though he, as you say, gave a rather modest acceptance speech.
Well, yeah. I mean, the funny thing about One Man, Two Governors at the Olivier Awards was that the show was a huge stonking success here and is still, of course, running with a new cast at the Haymarket. But it didn't actually win any Olivier Awards. It was nominated for 5 and lost them all. In New York, it was nominated for 7 Tony Awards, except weirdly not Best Play. So you think, how could all these terrific actors, designers, and a great director be in the services of not a great play? That was a bit weird. So it was nice that James Corden was recognized for the production as a whole, not just for him.
Let's talk about the other winners on the night. We had Nina Ariander won for Venus and Fur. That was actress in a leading role. Best play was Clybourne Park. Best revival was Death of a Salesman. Best actor in a leading role in a musical was Steve Kazee from Once. And Audra McDonald, of course, winning for the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, also making history, I believe. And what are your thoughts on the rest of the prizes?
Well, a little shout out, I think, to Audra McDonald, who doesn't appear in Britain as much as she should, although she has been in concert here. She's been at the Proms and at the Donmar. But she really is a kind of exquisite talent. Mm. This was her fifth Tony Award, although, funnily enough, her first for a leading role, the other 4 role for supporting roles, she is playing Bess in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. And it's a stupendous performance. And I think, you know, she's not like Ethel Merman at all, who of course was a previous generation, but in that Ethel Merman was a singular talent of a bygone Broadway era, so is Audra McDonald now. And I have a feeling that people in years to come will be very proud to have lived at a time when she was a Broadway star, because she has the most incandescent voice. I was very, very pleased that Once, the musical adaptation of the movie that you mentioned, won quite as many Tony Awards as it did. It won 8. It wasn't anticipated to do quite that well. The main competition for it is the latest Disney musical, a show called Newsies.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the old David versus Goliath thing. You go up against Disney, you're going up against the big boys. Even though, by Disney standards, Newsies is relatively small. I mean, this is not another Lion King. It's a much more modest effort. But Once is a sort of anti-Broadway, Broadway musical. It's very quiet.
And it was a micro-budget film in 2007.
Film, which, you know, went on to gross $20 million, which for a micro-budget film is a lot. But the show actually cost more money than the movie did, because Broadway is very expensive. But it's still incredibly modest compared to, say, Spider-Man the Musical.
Again, is this more of the fairy tale stuff?
I think so, but I think it's also about Broadway saying we don't have to just do glitz, we don't have to just do the big ta-da pizzazz number. Mm. We can do that. That's often what tourists think Broadway is exclusively. And Once is sort of an art house musical. It's a little bit like The Hurt Locker winning the Oscar for Best Picture.
Now, let's talk a bit about the people who didn't win on the night. Was there anyone there who you thought really should have triumphed, who didn't get through? I mean, obviously Brits will be sad that Andrew Garfield, who's one of our very, very top young British talents, didn't win for his role in Death of a Salesman.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge amount of buzz around Andrew Garfield, not least the fact that the show Death of a Salesman closed a few Saturdays ago, particularly so he could go off and promote Spider-Man. You know, he has to hit the promotional trail. And so people felt frustrated that they couldn't see it, but pleased, on the other hand, that a really hot young movie actor would choose to do a Broadway play. He doesn't have to. He could sit by the swimming pool in Beverly Hills.
But actually, if you know Andrew Garfield, he's so much more comfortable doing a little Broadway play than he is promoting Spider-Man.
I can imagine, and I remember him back at the National Theatre Cottesloe way back when nobody had any idea who he was. I mean, I think there was a real interest in this Tony ceremony and not going just for the big money shows, also not going for the big names. Mm. They didn't give the Tony to James Earl Jones. They didn't give it to Andrew Garfield. They didn't give it to Philip Seymour Hoffman. In a funny way, the biggest name amongst the winners was Mike Nichols, who directed Death of a Salesman, who now has 7 Tony Awards, and he's 80 years old and is a huge, you know, big deal director of film as well as theater. And Alan Menken, the composer who was responsible for Newsies, who's won 8 Oscars, but until last night had never previously won a Tony. So now he has a Tony to go with his 8 Oscars. Otherwise, it was sort of
going for the little guy. Huge relief this morning.
Oh, yes. Well, his bookshelf is probably feeling a bit more balanced.
Yeah. How big of a deal is it to win a Tony? I mean, you talked about James Corden. One Man, Two Governors has done fantastically. The reviews have been incredible on Broadway, but it hasn't been selling out every single night. Do you think it now will?
I think it probably will, particularly because New York is very Darwinian, very draconian. And what often happens, and we'll see this probably in the next few weeks, is the shows that were nominated and for whatever reason didn't win will start to close, particularly come the summer holidays when all the New Yorkers leave town, many of whom come to England. And the tourists.
This summer.
Exactly. And the tourists don't necessarily necessarily want to go see a heavy-duty play. They want to go see something like Newsies. So the Tonys are a big deal. It'll be interesting to see how people like James Corden capitalize on this. Will he end up in a television sitcom? Will he become a movie star? Will he be the comic Philip Seymour Hoffman? Time will tell.
Well, the first thing he's going to do is head back to the UK and marry his girlfriend. He thanked her very emotionally in that speech last night.
Yes, so, his baby mama.
His baby mama, exactly.
That was very lovely and very genuine. People were comparing it sort of sniffly to Gwyneth Paltrow, but I think that's completely unfair because with her it seemed insincere. This seemed completely from the heart.
It's been very interesting, actually, to see the development of James Corden's career and him, you know, his development as a person and the way that he conducts himself in public and the way, you know, he's had this kind of allegations of huge, gross arrogance and kind of not being very humble when he's made these speeches in the past, but it certainly seems that now, despite the fact that he's getting more and more successful, he's becoming more and more humble and gracious in his acceptance speeches.
Everything about his behavior in New York since he got there, as far as I can tell, has been about humility and about grace under pressure and about just seeing where the Broadway tide takes him, and at the moment it's taken him right to the top.
Well, he's a credit to us at this moment. Matt, well, thank you so much for joining us here on Midori House. Well, that's all for this Monday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 2200 London time, that's in 3 hours, Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller will be back with the Monocle Daily. Up next, after the news, you can enjoy the latest episode of The Culture Show with Rob Bound, so do stay tuned for that. Emma Nelson will be back at 1800 London time tomorrow to bring you another edition of Midori House. So until then, thanks for listening.